I'm Chris Barker.
And I'm Will Betts, and this is the Music Tech My Forever Studio podcast, brought to you in partnership with Audient.
In this podcast, we speak with artists, musicians, DJs, engineers, and producers about their fantasy forever studio.
The imaginary studio that our guests invent will be one that they must live with for eternity. But even in studio foreverdom, we have some rules.
That's right, the rules. Our guests will first select a computer, a DAW, and an audio interface. Those are free items that everybody gets. Then after that, they will choose just six other bits of studio kit plus one non-gear related studio item.
But
no bundles!
That's right, no bundles. Choosing something sold as a package of separate software or hardware as a single item is forbidden.
This time, we're joined by an artist, producer, songwriter, and music technology polymath who's taken the industry by storm with his music under various aliases, including The Flashbulb, and with his excellent YouTube channel.
Yes, if something is going on in the music tech industry, Ben knows all about it.
But will his studio be a tribute to the latest tech or hark back to the gear of yesteryear?
Bit of both, maybe?
Let's see.
This is My Forever Studio with Ben Jordan. Welcome.
Welcome, Ben.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Yeah, that,
good.
That's a lot of pressure. Yeah, especially since this is like coming way off the cuff. Like, you always want to make your hypothetical decisions very carefully, since they have no consequences whatsoever.
Exactly. Right? Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. And along the way, we'll be trying to upsell some dreams.
Upsell your dreams.
So yeah, if you start lowballing it and trying to be cool, we'll we'll try and get you to spend that fictional cash.
Yeah, okay.
On something fancy.
I like this.
So before we get into the construction of the studio, tell us about your sort of journey into music. I mean, for those that can't see, obviously that listening to the podcast, you're sat in quite an impressive studio room right now, but.
Oh, I'm in Guitar Center right now. I just asked them if I could sit. Hopefully they don't see me.
Did you start off as like a regular musician, if we can say that, and then delve into technology, or did technology was the thing that pulled you in?
I started as, like, when I was 5 or 6 years old, I started playing jazz guitar. Kind of on my own accord. Like, the only music that was being played in my household was kind of jazz. And so I really wanted a guitar. My step grandpa bought one for me. I brought it home, taught myself how to play the wrong way. I play upside down. So
that's jazz, baby.
Yeah, right. And so then I got into piano a little bit. I was in a band when I was a teenager. I was really, really dedicated, like, incredibly toxically focused on being the best at all the instruments. And then the rest of my band, you know, they were just normal teenagers who weren't that dedicated. And so I was like, well, I don't need it. I'll just get a drum machine. I could play the drums, and, you know, this way I'll just produce music on my own. And so I got a Boss DR660, and I would record into a karaoke machine and then just swap the tapes to multi-track. And I didn't really have any, you know, money to buy like a proper 4-track or something. And so, like, all of the beats that I were listening to when I was a kid were like Buddy Rich and stuff like that. And so I was just trying to recreate that stuff on the Boss DR660, which happens to be a great drum machine for that type of step programming if you want to get really into the weeds. And then that sort of defined a style of music that was one of the things that ended up getting, you know, signed to a label and ending up with me having a career in music. And so the electronic part didn't really come the same route that it does with most electronic musicians, where they hear a DJ and then want to make that music or something. It kind of
the route of trying of abandoning all of the people because they're not as dedicated as you is quite a familiar story in electronic music, though.
Is it? Yeah, I guess I could see that. Yeah,
many successful people where it's just like, just play the drums, just like, no. Okay, we're getting a machine.
Yeah. And it's a bit of a curse too, because then, yeah, I mean, if you like try and play a guitar part over a drum machine, then you start realizing like, oh, I'm very imperfect. This sounds terrible. Yeah. And so then you need to like add in humanization on the drum machine, and that kind of defeats the whole purpose of doing it in the first place.
When you were signing to a label, first off, you surely didn't pitch it as Buddy Rich on a DR660. Yeah. Like, what was the sell?
I think it was just, I had like a few in Chicago. I had a small group of people who were just really dedicated fans of my music. Like, they just thought that my music was like the bestest thing ever at the time. And then weirdly, over in the UK, that like the whole Warp Records thing was starting to blow up, and the Reflex Records and Aphex Twin and Square Pusher and all that, which is not that different in a lot of ways. And both those things, I started becoming inspired by Richard James and, you know, stuff like that as well around that time. And that's when I started being introduced to those musicians too, and touring, you know, either with them or alongside them. And so, yeah.
The artists that you started being associated with, they weren't influences when you first started making the music. It was kind of almost coincidence, if you want to put it that way, that you weren't aiming to be part of that scene or that world. You just were making music that you want to make, and it was kind of like, hey, there's other people doing this too.
Early on in my career, it was kind of, I always got called, like, even in the press, you know, sort of got called, you know, the wedding band version of Square Pusher, like, you know, the Square Pusher cover band or something, I never really was that bothered by, because I think that Tom Jenkinson, Square Pusher, I think he's an incredible musician, and being compared to him is, I've never been like really salty about that. But if you were to go back to when Tom and I were both younger, we both loved Buddy Rich. We both loved Jaco Pastorius, that fretless bass style. We both we both played with those types of older Roland drum machines and stuff. And so it's not totally crazy to have, you know, all of the ingredients and the same recipes making the same dish or making similar dishes. Yeah. So there's a lot of things where you could probably compare them side by side. And then I think once I started listening to Square Pusher, surely it ended up as part of that recipe.
For sure.
You both, I guess you start being influenced by the actual scene directly.
Yeah.
But how was it when you find out that there's other people doing this? Because part of it must be like, I'm onto something, and part of it must be like, oh, I thought I was the only guy doing this kind of cool.
No, it was really, really validating. It was because, think about like Chicago in the 1990s. Anything that wasn't 4/4 was just, you know, like heresy. I mean, it was like, that's where acid house started, right? And house music in general. And so mainstream radio stations were playing like acid house. And I still, to this day, I love acid house, but making crazy music like I was, but the music I was making at the time was just considered crazy, and like it was not accessible in any way. It was never going to get signed. I was never going to tour. And so it didn't look like I had a path forward until all that was happening in the UK. And then in the US in the late 90s, I started talking to Aaron Venetian Snares and Richard Devine. And those are like my two US buddies who were doing the same thing. And that was also very validating, because they were making music that was probably far stranger than mine at the time. So it was great.
Aaron Funk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have no idea why he changed his name. That's the coolest name ever. You don't need to be Venetian Snares. Aaron Funk. He's awesome.
He's one of the most like unique individuals I've ever met in my life. I love him to death.
Let's start building this fantasy studio. So we found out some stuff about where you started. Let's see where we end up. So Dream Studio, it can be anywhere in the world, any style.
Yeah.
Where would you put your dream studio in the world?
I mean, I like moved from Chicago down to the far off suburbs of Atlanta to kind of get away from the big city. But I've also now been thinking about moving even further out into the middle of nowhere. And I'm not sure if I'm okay with it. I'm kind of back and forth on it, because, you know, I do still want a Walmart somewhere nearby in case I need milk or, you know, something like whatever it is. I'm not sure it's great for your mental health to just coop yourself up, you know, in the middle of the desert or something. And so I think I would probably want to be somewhere beautiful near a major city. So maybe Malibu, California. Maybe if I just owned a lot of land in Malibu, like, which would cost billions of dollars. But hey, you know, we have that money in this fantasy. Although I feel like if I moved to Malibu, all my neighbors would be douchebags. So maybe, I would say maybe New Mexico. But I think what I would probably do is commandeer like Los Padres National Forest, which is... It's a national forest kind of north of Malibu. It's a little bit further from LA. Beautiful Mediterranean weather. It's absolutely massive. It's like, you know, the Revenant out there, except you're still within an hour drive from LA. I think I'd do that. I'd just commandeer the whole thing. Sorry to anybody who likes hiking there and stuff. You can't come on the property anymore. So, and then I would definitely need a moat around my house because
oh my God, here we go.
The California has this weird thing where it burns down every single year. And so I just want my moat to, you know, not be part of that burn down part. Yeah.
I'm glad you clarified it was for fire because I just thought it was for other people again.
Yeah. Yeah. I want a moat. I want sharks in the moat that are trained to fight fires.
A drawbridge just
see. Right, yeah. A fireproof drawbridge, yeah.
And what about the style of the studio then? I mean, is this kind of cabin in the woods or would it be some modern kind of construction?
Oh, it would be like super modern.
Okay.
It would be super artsy. Yeah. I don't know why, you know. I have no idea why. Probably because I have a YouTube production channel. So, you know, I'd be thinking in that regard.
Maybe, I'm picturing sort of Ex Machina kind of vibes.
Yeah, no, I'm thinking like similar to what you would have in like maybe an Italian Lake Vista or something, one of those like modern Euro style. Or Adobe, I might. But that's sort of like those two are sort of a similar style. I don't really know anything about architecture other than I like brutalism, but I don't think I would want to live in a brutalist house, just like a giant communist concrete.
That works in the forest. That's good. That's shocker.
That would.
It would survive a fire as well.
Yeah, actually. Okay. Then, yeah, let's go with that. Now that I think about it, I would live in a brutalist home that had just a lot of windows on the top because I'm moving to Los Padres National Forest. So I obviously want to see outside and, you know, see the coyotes and stuff. Yeah. So massive brutalist structure. Let's go with that. That sounds good.
And what's the kind of vibe you like to work with inside? Like, do you like lots of soft furnishings and the creative vibe? Or again, is it quite modern, quite spaceship-like? Or does that not matter?
Like,
does
anything I have is going to turn into a gigantic mess, no matter what it is. Like, every type of studio I've ever had.
Well, not in this studio, because you're only going to get 6 items.
Exactly. I know. That's what I'm thinking. Like, what is the mess going to be? Because if I can only... Yeah. So I guess it would be kind of cozy. I guess I really wouldn't need that much space. Maybe a little bit of space to exercise and stuff. And, you know, but...
You'd need the dojo as well, surely.
Yep.
Yeah, I guess I could have an octagon.
Oh my! We'll get to that. There's a whole bit.
Yeah, that's the fantasy item, right?
So, okay.
Like an octagon with like a UFC fighter in it at all times.
Just, okay, well,
that could just beat the crap out of me when I make a mistake.
Yeah. Nice. So, in terms of the working environment, then, do you like to have windows around? Do you like to have it completely blacked out and be able to have complete control over the space, the lighting in the space?
I like to have windows. That's like the one luxury that I can't have here, just where I live.
Right.
Like, not that like windows are like banned in Georgia, but I just it's below ground and I can only have windows in certain areas.
Right.
So,
it's like ye old English time and the taxes on the windows for the king.
Yeah.
Right.
It's the one remaining place in the world that has that where you lived.
Yeah. No, we got window tax, gravity tax. It's terrible here.
Okay. Well, let's all visualize that and move on to the three free items, which is your DAW, your audio interface, and your choice of computer. So these don't count towards your 6. These are just the basics that we give everybody. But tell us what you would choose for those things.
DAW would probably be, it would be FL Studio. That's been the DAW I've been using since I've been using DAWs. And also, I feel like that probably is the most complete as a package. Like, I feel like I could produce music just from installing that DAW. There's a couple things I miss, like, you know, a good solid piano sound or something, but... I think that would be, kind of a dead ringer for that.
Not a regular choice, is it, on the podcast? But it's I've always found it strange. Maybe it's the guests we're having, but it's not chosen that often. But actually,
people still see
massive.
It as like, it's like, like every year at like NAMM, they always have like the smallest little booth, and I'm always thinking like, I think this is the richest company here.
Yeah, it's gotta
be. It's the most successful company in music. Yet like everybody sees them still as this like, oh, that's the thing amateurs use, but.
Yeah, and it used to be like, it used to be quite European centric. And I remember when I started going to the States and started seeing what, well, basically once hip hop grabbed hold of it as well.
Yeah.
It's just because it was kind of like it started to infiltrate European dance scene and started transitioning from being like, you know, the toy or the entry level to being, oh, that hit was made with it, that hit was made with it. But it was very EDM. And then hip hop and those guys grabbed it, and it seems pretty much everybody is using it. On, I wish on credits it would show you the like the percentage of the DAW that's used.
I think a lot of people don't admit to using it, which is kind of funny. And I'm guilty of that back in the day. Like, I used to do TV scoring and film scoring work. And if I worked in a different studio, they would have like a Pro Tools HD system set up, and I would have a laptop with FL Studio. And it would be like unprofessional for, I would be worried that I wouldn't get hired for another gig if I got caught using FL Studio. Like, it was that funny. Same with like colleges. Like, if I ever did a talk at a college or anything like that, I would be like embarrassed to talk about the DAW that I use, because I would be like, I'm never going to get hired again if I'm.
Yeah, I think that was a familiar thing in hip hop. Like, it seemed like, and dance music initially, when I saw it get massive in the industry, it was, or in the pro end of the industry, it was always on somebody's laptop in a studio where they were streaming bits of it into
Right.
Pro Tools.
Yeah. Yeah.
And kind of like running it like an instrument rather than its own thing. And it always sort of had to end up in Pro Tools. And if you interviewed people about it, they'd say, we did it in Pro Tools.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, it must be one of those things where, you know, like people see DAWs as a luxury. And Pro Tools was the most expensive at the time, so that made you the most professional. Whereas FL Studio, most people at that time were using like a cracked version of it, and so that made you unprofessional. You know, people just, I guess it is just sort of like hierarchical financial gatekeeping in a weird way. I mean, but that exists everywhere. That exists with like our clothes and shoes and cars, and so it would only. But
yeah, I think this is with the DAW side. I think it's totally falling apart now. I don't think.
Yeah.
With people having multiple DAWs and people really not giving a damn what they made their record on.
Yeah,
like, it doesn't matter at all.
But question on the DAW though. So all of the drum programming you've done for your entire career then has all been in FL Studio, because it's an extremely complex drum programming that's gone on. Is beyond using it already, is there a reason why FL Studio is more suited to the kind of music that you make or have made?
Yeah, most of the music that like you would hear on Spotify or any of my like available discography was probably either back in the older stuff would be a Roland JX-305 was my primary drum sequencer. And then once I started using DAWs, which was like early 2004, you could hear the shift in my music where it just kind of went completely crazy, because I was like, oh, I'm going to use a computer for this instead. That would be FL Studio. And FL Studio, objectively, like I feel like anybody who's used it or even paid attention to it for long enough would agree with me saying that like its strongest suit is its piano roll. Like, the piano roll tools are just nuts. Like, and nothing else even comes close to it, unfortunately, because I wish that every DAW had that level of power. And, you know, you can really, really get extremely focused and deep into programming. And also another thing that I do is I don't really loop patterns like a lot of people do in DAWs and stuff. I kind of just start from, you know, the first note and then go the entire track in one thing. And I try and do as little copying and pasting as possible, just because, I don't know, that makes it a more interesting song. Like, you have more room for variation and play and stuff. So,
love that.
So you still track like it's a tape machine, essentially?
Kind of, yeah. Yeah, even if I'm drawing out each note, it's like, it's, I feel like that's, I'll just get bored if I use patterns for some reason. And it's like, obviously there's, you know, a million songs that use patterns that are brilliant that I could never even hope to make something that cool. But for me, I just get bored if I'm using patterns typically.
Yeah, well, there's something to be said in that. We've talked about it a lot on many of these podcasts, where it's just finding that way that you work and not being influenced by other people's way, because you can just get lost changing. I mean, I've met many artists that get obsessed with seeing other people's studios and how it's set up or the gear they're using, and then they change up there and they just never settled. And then you've got other people that are still using, you know, computers from 2002 because they're just like, I've always used this and it works.
Yeah.
And it's some kind of middle ground to find where you don't mess with what works. There's a lot of people that have gear in their studio that they don't use, but the gear itself is kind of inspiring, even though it doesn't make it onto the record. They know they don't need it, but sitting in front of a laptop isn't inspiring.
There's like an open secret in this entire industry that I definitely believe in a lot more, you know, learned a lot more about when having a YouTube channel. The people who buy music gear and the people that are generally, like, you know, keeping the companies afloat, I would say more than half of them are not really making music on it. They're kind of just collecting it and playing with it. Mm-hmm. Even DAWs and software, like, they just buy the software, they play with the knobs, they listen to it for a second, and there's no shame in it at all. Like, that's the big thing, is there's this kind of, everybody pretends like they're making music in it, but there are a lot of people who just like collecting synths and collecting DAWs and learning, and because they're not, you know, producing music that people are listening to, for some reason that they're not as validated. And I think that's nonsense, because it is a hobby one way or another. And collecting synthesizers is a way cooler hobby than, like, a lot of other hobbies that people have, right? It's yeah, I mean, people have crazy hobbies. People play pickleball. They do, you know, not that there's anything wrong with pickleball, but people, you know, they do all sorts of things.
Just play tennis.
Yeah. Yeah, but, you know, like, fly fishing, people stand in a river all day. Like, there's tons of hobbies that, like, are kind of absurd. And I think that collecting synthesizers that look and sound cool, or software that, like, is really unique in its own space, is one of the less absurd hobbies. So I kind of wish that that was a little bit less of a secret and a little bit more of a, you know, oh, you know what? Actually, I do like collecting synthesizers, and I have no intention of using them in music, and that's fine.
Yeah, I think you come across a lot more of those people now than you used to. Mm-hmm. It's become like, you know, like the guys that collect guitars as well. It's gone into that same world. I think maybe when 20, 30 years ago, they were seen as something that you would have to make music with. Why would you want it? Because it's not a real instrument as such, but now they are real instruments,
yeah,
and accepted.
Oddly enough, probably like 7 or 8 years now, I met Herbie Hancock, and that was his number one complaint, is that things are getting less and less musician friendly, like, in the synth world, because he was trying to use, like, an iPad with his, he had like a solo piano set, but he was trying to use an iPad in it, and he was having a little bit of, he wasn't really excelling at it very much, and he was like, it's just that more and more things are coming out without keyboards, or without, like, any way that you can interact in real time with them. And that's so true. And that makes me wonder if that's why the collecting thing is coming. Like, a modular synth is way easier to collect than to make music on for a lot of people, I think. Whereas, you know, like the Osmos or something, or I guess like some sort of, you know, big keyboard, you almost can't not learn how to play some chords on it. And you know, try and make some music.
That's true, actually. And even if they did have interfaces, it started being pads.
Yeah.
Or ways to, or even like, you know, Ableton Push style. It became, well, how can we break the keyboard concept? Because having a keyboard on something puts off the non-musician, and that's part of the market share that we want. Because so you've seen a keyboard, they go, well, I can't play keyboard.
Right, yeah.
So immediately.
And
whereas if you put pads or buttons on it, it looks like something new, and I can be the first person to learn how to make music on an Ableton Push or a Tenorion or
whatever. And I'll tell you one thing, if you take those, if you were to lob all of those enthusiast sales off of the industry, then we would have nothing to make music with, like you know, on the other end of it, like, they're as required as ours, if not more. So it's a good thing, ultimately. Like, it keeps things going. It keeps creative people employed, which is great.
Yeah. So what are we thinking for your audio interface? I've locked in FL Studio.
Yeah, audio interface. I mean, I guess I'm just going to choose, like, an RME Maddie face. Maybe.
Solid.
Maybe Fireface 802. Just, yeah, what I'm already using. Like, something with a solid driver. Like, RME has really, really solid drivers, and they update them like 10 years, 12 years after you buy the interface. Like, there's probably one of the best values. It's like your lifetime interface. Like, you kind of buy it once and you never really think about it again. The biggest downside of any audio interface is having to deal with, like, a new interface, or having to deal with driver issues or latency or whatever. And so I feel like that just, RME seems to deal with that the best. One question that I have, What's the deal with monitors? I don't mean that in like the Jerry Seinfeld way. What's the deal with monitors? You look at one in the screen and you hear them? No, is this included in my freebies or is that one of my pieces of gear?
No, your freebies are your audio interface, your computer, and your DAW.
Okay.
But monitors do come as a pair. We're fair on that.
Okay.
But if you want monitors, they will be when we start your six items.
Yeah. Okay.
And some people have been rogue and and not chosen monitors. Really?
They're just going to listen to like the little BIOS speaker in their computer.
Exactly. Yeah. Speaking of which, what computer would you go with? Because your forever computer, what's that going to be?
I guess it'll just be the one I have now. I don't really have any allegiance, which I think is a... It's one of the newer generation Intel i9s.
So we're on Windows.
Yeah, Windows has an RTX 4080, I think, because I do some like AI stuff on here. And yeah, I mean, it has a bunch of solid state drives that are paired in a RAID thing. And so...
Nice.
I mean, it pretty much does video editing, which is probably the most demanding thing that you could... throw at a computer is like 4K, 6K video editing. And so it does that fine. Music, other than the Zebralette plugin, that new one, that actually maxed out my CPU, which was kind of hilarious because nothing has maxed out my CPU before. When that was like somehow, somehow that plugin did.
Is that a new Yuhi one?
Yeah, I checked it out on a stream and my CPU just went all the way and I was just like, whoa. What? Really? Like how many partials are we doing? Like millions?
It must be.
Do you want to
upsell your dreams
to the most specced out Windows machine you could have? We have the budget.
But I might have the... I guess I'd increase the video card to an RTX 4090, which is one step up, I suppose.
Okay, there we go.
I don't know what's... I don't know what's like what's faster. I'd like to do a benchmark, maybe. While I'm on this podcast, I'd like to just
let's get into it.
Benchmark my entire system. But, okay, wait, guys, hold on. Yeah. It's going. Yeah.
Unedited.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's quite rare on the podcast for people to choose PC over Mac. I mean, any reason? Is it that the FL? Is it the FL thing? And then building your own? Or
yeah, why I do like to build my own. I like to, like my system, it looks almost like a treasure chest size. It's a massive machine that's like under an entire table over there.
Oh, wow.
And it has like liquid cooling. It runs very quiet. Mm-hmm. I can even do things like, you know, train an AI model or something like that and have it relatively quiet without, you know, the fans will spin up, but they're super quiet fans. And so I put a lot of work into that to make it, you know, a studio machine. Even Apple's, what's the Apple Studio or Mac Studio, whatever mm-hmm. that is, that thing's really loud. Like that thing's actually mm-hmm. quite a few decibels. So I would still, even if I had that, I would be putting it, hiding it away behind a bunch of like padding and stuff, but I would just not have any room to expand it. Whereas this one, if I feel like a drive's going out or if I feel like there's any sort of problem, it's really easy to just stick my head in there and look around and be like, oh, there we go. Here's our issue. So, yeah. But I do like the expandability and I guess the modularity. It is kind of modular in there too. So, yeah.
Appropriate.
The Music Tech My Forever Studio podcast is supported by Audient, makers of the ID range of audio interfaces.
Yes, building on Audient's 25 years of design heritage, the ID range spans from the portable ID4 to the more feature-packed ID14 and 24 interfaces, all the way up to Audient's powerhouse desktop interface, the ID44.
You can expect rugged build quality and exceptional audio performance across the entire range, with every ID interface using the same award-winning console mic preamps found in their renowned recording console, the ASP8024HE.
The ID24 is the latest addition to the range, featuring two of those console mic preamps, along with balanced inserts, a JFET instrument input, ADAT expandability, and customizable monitor control, making the ID24 and its larger sibling, the ID44, perfect for using with outboard equipment and tracking instruments and vocals.
That's right, and the Audient ID24 is available now, priced at £299, €349, and $399.
Visit audient.com for more information and to explore the full ID interface range.
let's move on to item number one.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's going to have to be monitors because I want to hear things. Here's another place where I get kind of lost. I had the Yamaha H8000s. Was that what they are? H8s?
HS80s.
Yeah, those.
Yeah.
This is how much I care about monitors. I had those and a KRK sub for, I mean, since the Yamahas came out. So for a very, very long time.
What's that, 2008 or something? 2009?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, like I was going on like 15 years or something. And I literally was just like, well, I should probably upgrade my monitors. And I did just because people kept complaining. Every time they came in my studio, they'd complain about the crappy Yamaha monitors I had, which I thought were totally fine. And I'm still trying to adjust. Now I have like the, whatever the premium iLouds are. Again, I care so much about monitors, I don't know any of the names. And I got those because they come with microphones and they just adjust themselves to the room. And that saves me a lot of time. And then even if I like, you know, if I move that synth rack behind me, I have a synth rack behind me right now. If I were to move that around, I would probably do a readjustment. So, a Genelec Atmos system. Can I get one of those?
Yeah, you can. It's a hell of an upgrade. Yeah, sure. Love it.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, that's like probably the most expensive thing that I could think of off the top of my head. Maybe like the Neumann KH420, the 10 inches.
Ooh,
those are nice. But
those are nice.
Yeah. I mean, something like just something with a wide range. And I guess if I can't have that much gear, if this is all I have, then I'm probably going to want to fool around with surround stuff at some time. And I like ambisonic stuff. And so I'll figure out a way to make that work on the Genelec Atmos system. Richard Devine told me that the Genelec Atmos system is great, so I believe him, and that's all I need. But yeah, I mean, a lot of my older albums, I literally mastered them on Logitech speakers, like in 2002, 2000, even Curly and Selections, the one you mentioned before we started, that was mastered on Logitech speakers. Like,
wow.
I don't know.
Well, like PC speakers that sit on the desk, like the little sort of gray ones.
Yeah, with like the little sub and yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I completely made that and mastered it on those speakers, and the label was like, yeah, this sounds good. And I was like, okay, here we go. And
so, that's nuts.
And after that, I bought some Mackie monitors or something.
Yeah, they were like, they,
the cheapest ones, like the ones Behringer ripped off.
Yeah, but everybody loved those. They sounded like a PA system.
Yeah.
But they were great. I had HS as well or something?
HR824s, were they?
HR824s, yeah. I had the 624s, which were awful.
Oh.
I got the 624s thinking that they'd be like a small version of the 824s, but no, they sounded completely different. They had this weird hole in the bass.
Oh, really? Huh.
Yeah, people do not buy the 624s secondhand. They sound fine, but working on them was a nightmare. And I didn't realize that was, you know, when you just think, I've lost it, I can't mix, I don't know, everything sounds terrible outside of the room. And then I changed monitors to some little Genelecs and, oh, it sounds like normal again.
Like, that's one of the sellers of the iLouds is that sort of auto calibration. Like that, because that just saved me my own guesswork. Because when I first built this studio down here, it's totally dead. I mean, it's like weird if you clap your hands in here. It's kind of, it's a completely dead room, which I don't recommend for anybody who's building a studio. I do not recommend having a dead room. It's actually kind of hard on your ears. It gets very exhausting. Like, I never listen to music for fun down here. I only work on it. But yeah, I mean, I went through this exhaustive process of like getting it perfect, as good as I could with it, you know, every adjustment. And then I realized at the end of the day, just listening to a song I'm really familiar with and then just, you know, turning the sub up a little bit and turning the monitor down a little bit. And that kind of was the better way of doing it.
Yeah. For me, it was just listening to music on your monitors like it's your hi-fi.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter how crappy they are. You get subliminally tuned into what music sounds like.
Yeah. Snoop Dogg's Sexual Eruption is my go-to song, like when I would tour.
That's the name of a record, right?
Yeah, it's a song. It's not
people might notice Sensual Seduction over here. I think it got
he had like a weird like safe version of it, didn't he?
Yeah,
even though the song isn't really all that vulgar, but that song is mixed kind of weird. Like there's a bass and then there's a sub bass beneath that. And if you have any sort of crossover from your monitors to that subwoofer, it always shows up in that song to me. And so that song's always my go-to when tuning an audio system. But even on tour, which is really funny because every sound check, I would play Sexual Eruption for my sound check. And they'd be like, don't you want to like play it? And I'm like, no, I got my mixer up here. I got, as long as the monitors work, I'm fine. But I need to hear Sexual Eruption out there to make sure that you know, that we don't have muddy bass.
Yeah. And you've got promoters going, are you sure we booked the right guy?
Right, yeah. Yeah.
Amazing. We're going to lock in that Genelec system. Have you got that, Will?
The Genelec Atmos Package 1, it's called.
Okay.
Okay.
What's
okay.
the retail on that?
Goes for, in the UK, 12,000, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, so let's move on to item number two.
Yeah. Yamaha Disclavier Grand Piano.
Okay.
I have a Disclavier upright. The reason I don't have a grand is because I don't have the space, nor I'm not sure if I would spend like $90,000 on a piano, but it would be Disclaviers are not cheap, but even the uprights. But
I didn't even know they did an upright. Does that still play itself?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I can send MIDI to it and stuff. I don't really use that function other than like on my YouTube channel. Like it's a great thing to like have a sequencer and put it in there and test it around, you know, and play generative music or something. But I do just play the piano normally. I don't really run MIDI through it all that often. But
it's cool if you want to record though and you've only got you.
Yeah. Having that capability is great, and it is a way to inspire yourself if you've run out of ideas.
And get great mic placement as well, because you can have it just running.
Yeah, I have the whole front open, and I generally, even when I'm playing, I try to be as quiet with my fingers as possible, but like I'll have the mics almost like down from the ceiling, like right in front of me, pointed into the soundboard. So yeah, one of those, but you know, the full-scale grand piano would be much easier to mic, and I'd be able to do more things with clamping things on the...
We can go full-scale grand piano here?
Yeah.
Is that what we're going for? Yeah.
Yeah. In my brutalist piano room, yeah.
Upselling dreams?
Upsell your dreams. Yeah, love it.
Good. Is that in black? We're getting the black finish?
Yeah.
Not brutalist, gray.
Gray, yeah. Yeah, dark gray would be nice too. I don't know. I mean, I guess I'll make them paint me one that's custom. So, yeah, let's do gray.
With your face on the lid.
Yeah. My dog's face. Yeah. I want her to look at herself and wonder if it's a mirror while I play.
Just terrified.
Just like why am I being tested for my sentience every day?
Item number three.
I'm going to need a MIDI controller. This one's rough.
Can you not send MIDI out of the Disclavier?
You can, but it gets a little tricky. I mean, it's kind of weird to like play a pad when you have a piano playing in real life right in front of you. You know, it's kind of, it's difficult. I don't really use it for that ever. I might use the Osmos as my MIDI controller. Because it is one of those things where if I'm locked in this room with only six things, I feel like I could kind of spend a lifetime learning how to play the Osmos better, like turning off the limiting on the key vibration and stuff. And then I feel like there's a whole instrument to learn there if I had the time that is beyond that. But also it has the Hacken editor, if you're familiar with that. And that's another like whole alternative form of synthesis that you can't really do in a DAW. You can't really do with a plugin. It kind of only works with the hardware, you know, and so with the Egan Matrix and stuff. So I suppose that's a good ringer, even though it's not full size.
So essentially it's a controller, but it comes with sounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you could you could use the Egan Matrix to edit the sound. But I mean, there's a lot that you could do with it. You could kind of make it your only instrument for a year and probably come up with some really crazy things.
So imagine if you had all of time in the Forever Studio.
Yeah, it's one of those things that's like very expandable, whereas otherwise if I were to just choose my like, what is this thing? Keylab 88 Make 2. It was like the best MIDI piano controller I've ever played in my life. But I can't do anything other than what I'm already doing with the piano on it, you know?
Yeah. So you've got the Disclavier for that, so yeah.
Right, yeah, exactly.
So have you used the Osmos much on your music, or is that sort of yet to make an appearance on the music you're releasing?
Right now, due to software issues, I am only recording it in if I want it to, because MPE is such a mess, right? Like, I think the only thing that where I could just plug it in and start mapping something like SWAM strings or something like that is Bitwig. I think Bitwig's the only software that's like fully thumbs up MPE, embracing MPE. But yeah, I'm not sure. Like the specs of MPE are even different depending on who you ask. Mm-hmm. And then that's kind of like mixed in with the MIDI 2.0 thing. Like it's so hard to follow any of that stuff. And, but yeah, I do use it in my music for sure. Cause it could create some like really expressive sounds that I really love.
Item number four.
I'm going to go with a Rode NTSF1 ambisonic microphone. That's probably the microphone that I could push the most to make it do what I want. It could be a shotgun, it could be a stereo mic, it could be a ambisonic mic. It could kind of do whatever with the sound field plugin as well, where you could arrange the things around in different ways and it decodes the ambisonic. So yeah, probably that.
That's kind of a good hack when you've only got limited.
Right, it's kind of like the most like universally capable microphone.
You've gone for a lot of surround and Atmos capable equipment here. So,
yeah,
tell us more about that. Is that something you've played with a bunch, or have you released? Are you releasing in Atmos? Like, what's going on with that?
No, I got some of Dolby's marketing reached out years ago asking me if I wanted to mix my next Flashbulb album in Atmos, and have a video of me going, man, I never knew that my music could sound this good. You know, one of those things. And I was like, nah, I'm good. It's just like, and they're like, are you sure? Free, we'll fly out and everything. I was like, nah, I'm good. I'm fascinated with ambisonic audio. I'm fascinated with archiving things. It is clear. And a lot of times I record places that have no noise pollution at all. And I go way out of my way to like get to these places to archive them. And that, I usually use the ambisonic microphone, and that's just like the most data that I could get out of that. Like a good 32-bit, 192 kilohertz ambisonic recording is pretty solid way to archive something. And also you could mix it and you could normalize it and you could do all sorts of different things that can make it sound different. And so I think that's my fascination. As far as the Genelec Atmos thing goes, I don't really care about the codec at all. I just want more speakers. Like if I, you know.
You're just like cycling out a stereo pair over and over.
Yeah.
Forever.
Yeah. Honestly, that's probably, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Like I probably would never use more than like the sub and the two speakers, but like you're giving me unlimited money here. I got like Musk bucks. So yeah, I'll buy them. So, but no, I'm actually pretty critical of Atmos, to be honest, or at least the push of everybody to like start mixing their music in Atmos when the vast majority of people listen to music on their like phone speaker or on a Bluetooth speaker, or, you know, an Amazon Echo or something. So it's kind of, the whole thing's absurd, but yeah.
I mean, you're not afraid of being sort of vocal about certain things. I'm kind of intrigued when you're saying you didn't want to go out and do the testimonial for Atmos. I mean, would that have sort of run counter to what you're doing on your YouTube channel and your sort of ethos there?
I mean, it was before I became critical of things like that on YouTube as much. Like I was still kind of gear centric and not as open about those things at the time. There's like two things here. One, when it comes to sponsorships, so when it comes to making money through sponsorships and stuff, you need to do it in every line of work. However, right now, like one of the reasons I have a YouTube channel, one of the reasons I've wrote music for ads for so many years and stuff like that is so the Flashbulb never had to touch that. Like that's the sacred thing that never touches sponsorships or anything like that. And so when any company comes out and says, yeah, but you know, we'd like to sponsor the Flashbulb for this, or we'd like to, even shows, even like, you know, we'd like to pay you more money to have a can of, you know, energy drink on stage, and nobody would really notice it was a sponsorship. I feel like that's always been just a hard rule for me, where it's like, nope, this is my therapy. This is the thing that has saved my life over and over again. It will never be touched by that sort of vibe, I guess. But not to be like, I don't know, it sounds like I'm hypercritical of advertising when I say that. It's just like my comfort zone is like, nope, Dolby's not going to get the flashbulb name.
But that's the best place to be, where you've got the reality of earning a living and you've got this project that you can keep, like you say, sacred. I think that's a good way to do it. It's a good way to teach other people how to do it as well, that you can have these different hats and different profiles.
Yeah, I will get burnt out on YouTube. It's going to happen. You know, like I'm going to quit at some point. I'm going to quit everything else. I'm not going to quit writing music. I'm not going to let that happen, because I know how these things build up. And I think the reason why so many people, you know, tap out is because they over-monetize their own craft, and then it becomes a job, and it becomes, and they want to retire from working. Whereas I don't want to retire from making music. I love it. I want to retire to make music. And so, which also kind of goes into what we were talking about earlier with like financial people seeing themselves as professional or not professional based on like how much money they're making from their music or how much money they're spending on a DAW or something like that. I mean, I know a lot of people who have had careers in music that were really successful and also had a side job. Charlie, the late Charlie Cooper from Telephone Tel Aviv, he was one of my best friends. He worked at a restaurant. He waited tables while Telephone Tel Aviv was like in their height. And he did it because he didn't want to monetize Telephone Tel Aviv as his primary source of income, because then he would be more likely to write music that would be a pop hit than writing music that he actually wanted to write, which is like such a logical, great way to look at that. And so what a great way to like, you know. And so I think I learned a lot from him in that too, where I was like, okay, I'm okay with writing music for ads. It's not really selling out as long as I put my art here and then have my service on this side and keep those two worlds separate. That's been the way I've been able to deal with it, because obviously, money and art are just don't really mix very well.
No, not quite.
Yeah. It's the difficult second and third album, isn't it? Of a lot of people, where the first catalogue of music that people make is in a bedroom with no aspirations of it ever breaking through, and it's for them, and that's what makes it brilliant. And then as soon as you've got team around you saying more of that, or do it like this, or here's the market research, here's the feedback, here's the data, do more tracks like that, less tracks like that,
and it's just interesting too. Like if I were to go on Twitter right now or something, or X or whatever you want to call it, and if I were to say I want to make some new music, what kind of album should I make? I guarantee the vast majority of those responses are going to be telling me to make another album like one that I previously made. It's not going that when like the answer should be, and the answer really is, make one that makes us feel challenged like the one did. You know what I mean? Like don't make another one like that. Make one that makes us feel as challenged and enlightened by whatever we liked previously.
But that's why you can't ask people what they want, because people don't know what they want until they get it.
And if you ask people what they want and then you react on that, you're providing a service, not art, right? Because you just make art. Art is, to me, art's something that, like, you're creating something because you love creating, and that's the only reason you're doing it, right? And a service is when you're, you know, trying to monetize it in some way. And both are valid, you know? It's not like one's good and one's bad, but I think that that's the way I always separate it in my head. So, yeah, the ambisonic.
You know, I love that.
Okay.
Okay, well, let's get on to let's get on to item number five. Let's get on to item number five.
Yeah. Back in, like, 2001 or something, a friend of mine who worked at a guitar center, he was like, Ben, you got to get in here. We just bought a used Schecter guitar. And I was like, I've never heard of Schecter at the time. And he was like, well, it's a good brand, Ben. And it has a MIDI pickup on it. And nobody here even knows, like, how to work that. And so, you know, do you want it or not? And so I came down and I was like, oh, man, this thing has the best action out of any guitar I've ever played in my life. I don't even need to strum it. And that has been, it's like a Frankenstein Schecter with MIDI pickups. And then I've put more modern MIDI pickups on it over the years. I've brought that to all over the world touring. It's been my primary guitar on tour. I've used it in albums. It's just the best playing guitar that I've ever had. And now it's, after the years, it's starting to lose its amazing playability, but still, that would have to come with me. That's like the one thing that isn't breathing where I would mourn it if my house burnt down, you know? Like, everything else, I'd be like, I don't care, whatever. I got an insurance plan. But that guitar, I would be like, I'm never going to play that again. Like, I'm never going to find anything like that. So that would have to come with me, and that would be my guitar.
Is that the, you got the Roland MIDI pickups on it? Is it the GR10 stuff, was it?
The GK, I think I have the GK3 in it now, which okay. is still kind of old. Like, that's like 8 years old. The MIDI pickup technology hasn't really advanced much anyway, so...
It's pretty good at tracking chords, not just single notes and all this kind of thing.
Yeah, well, it is a different instrument. It is a completely different. I feel like, so there's like Roland GK MIDI, which is, it's not really MIDI until you have an output from the GK system, and then you could, you know, plug that into the computer or plug that into a synth or whatever. The latency is really good. You can change the height and space of each of the string's pickups, because there's like six different pickups on it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's customizable enough. It's more customizable, in my opinion, than like the Fishman MIDI pickup or something like that. Mm-hmm. And Roland, especially back in like their older things, they definitely had a good amount of options in the synthesizers that you could control with it. But I just feel like that's the one that I'm the most comfortable with, probably, so... But now I just realized that I can't really use any of the MIDI stuff unless I have a MIDI translator of some sort. So that sucks.
So, item number six.
Yeah, no, I can't. I don't care about MIDI guitar enough for that. I'll just rip that thing off. Yeah. I mean, I don't really use MIDI. I use MIDI guitar a lot for, I would use MIDI guitar a lot for performing live. But, you know, most of the time in albums, it would only appear, you know, sparingly, so I don't really need it.
Let's move on to the final item, right, Will?
Final item, yeah.
Item number six.
This one's tough. I don't know if I want a Jaco Pistorius bass, the Fender Jaco bass, or if I want a Runroco. Oh, I'm going to have to give one of those instruments up for life.
You could take Jaco's actual bass.
Oh, yeah, I guess I could. Although I imagine that's probably not that great. Like, it would be cool to have, but I imagine, like, I think he threw it in the ocean in Japan. And, like, I mean, I think it's been through some, if you ever want a good music tech writing piece, the history of that bass is very interesting. I've followed up on that a few times, because at one point I was going to make a YouTube video about it, but then I realized, like, nobody cares. And, you know, for, like, my channel audience, just like, Jaco, who? But yeah, that's a pretty fascinating story, because that ended up like in a pawn shop or something at some point. Nobody realized what it was. But yeah, I'll take the newer recreation with like the more, you know, properly coated pickups and the newer fretboard and stuff. But I think I'm going to take my Runroco instead, because I feel like I just get more joy playing the Runroco. And then I'll just miss the bass for the rest of my life. But I feel like I would miss the Runroco more, because I kind of play the Runroco. That's probably the instrument I play the most if I'm just like letting my dog out in the yard and, you know, waiting for her to go to the bathroom. That's the instrument I pick up, probably because of its portability. But it just sounds so big for how small it is. And if for anybody who's listening and doesn't know what that is, it's a bass charango. And anybody who doesn't know what that is, it's like a small Andean, like I believe they either started in Argentina or Peru. I think Peru is where they started, and it has five sets of two strings, so it has 10 strings total, and so it's like an Andean mandolin almost, and it just sounds gorgeous. Probably its most popular use in music that I could name. I mean, I use it all the time, but I'm not that popular. What is popular is Gustavo Santaolalla, if I'm saying his name correct. Mm-hmm. He did the Last for Us score with a lot of Runroco, which is, yeah, one of the all-time best scores for video games. So, yeah.
Wow.
And, of course, they used the same score again for the TV show as well, which is enormously popular.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah,
that's where I know it.
exactly the same soundtrack. Yeah.
The TV show.
It's a fantastic sound, isn't it? It's the, so they octave tuned each of those strings like a 12-string guitar.
Yeah.
Nice. That makes sense.
Yeah. But it's a little tricky. Like, it, basically the way it works is if you pluck a string up to lower, or I guess like higher to lower, then you get like the higher end of the sound. And if you pluck it the other way around, then you get the bass end of the sound. And so that actually kind of affects the way that a sequence is played. Generally, when the instrument was initially made, it was only made to be strumming super fast. And then, like, you know, the Andean flute would be like the lead instrument in that ensemble. But yeah, I guess the way that Gustavo and then whoever wants to sound like Gustavo, including myself, plays it, it's generally more classical guitar style. And that's when you have to pay a lot of attention to what direction you're plucking a string in, which is pretty cool.
And so was that your introduction to it through Gustavo Santaolalla?
I had a charango before that that I played the same way.
Oh, okay.
And I really liked that. And but I heard Gustavo's music very long ago, like I think in like 2000 or something. He did the score for Amoros Perros, which is a fantastic film. It's like maybe my top film of all time. It's one of the best films I've ever seen. And it's directed by Alexander Iñárritu, who did Babel, 21 Grams, The Revenant, and Birdman. So yeah, he's done a lot of like now much more famous films, but Amoros Perros was like his first big indie film, and it's fantastic. And that was Gustavo's breakthrough film for composing. And so the ending of that film has one of the most gorgeous, massive plucked string ensembles I've ever heard. And it's like also this heartbreaking moment in the film, which, you know, just
no spoilers.
Yeah.
We're both going to go away and watch that afterwards.
Only because I haven't seen it, and I was like, "Oh, it's good to have new recommendations."
Yeah. Well, the one thing, if you've never seen an Iñárritu film, the heartbreaking point is not like a death. It's more spiritual or something. It's like he knows when to like shoot the energy at you in a way where you don't expect it. You're just like, "Oh God, yeah." So,
okay. Well, let's have a listen back. Will can describe back the studio that you've built, and then we'll go on and finish with your luxury item.
Oh, yeah.
Will, take it away. Set the scene.
We're in Los Padres National Forest, California, in a brutalist building surrounded by a moat, but with windows to have natural light and to see the coyotes. Your computer is a Windows PC with an Intel i9, an RTX 4090, graphics processor. Your interface is an RME Fireface 802. Your DAW is FL Studio. For your first item, you have chosen the Genelec Atmos package. Your second item is a Yamaha Disclavier grand piano with a painting of your dog's face on it. Your third item is the Expressive E Osmos. Item number four is the Rode NTSF1. Your penultimate item is the Frankenstein Schecter guitar with Roland GK3 MIDI pickups, your very own. And your final item is a Ronroco. Do you want to pick your own Ronroco, or do you want a specific one from history or from another famous person?
No, I would pick my... I've gone through quite a few, and I have like a favorite, because if you want a Ronroco, you generally have to find a luthier in Latin America to make one for you. And so it is a bit of a challenge because some of them are better than others. So yeah, I would take my prized Ronroco.
Beautiful. Do you think you can make music with that setup? How does that work for you?
Yeah, I think that's good. It's kind of funny hearing it back, it like, and then imagining whatever, like, you know, BT or Deadmau5 chose, it probably, like, people are probably like, are you sure he doesn't want to live in a caravan? Like, like setup? But like...
No, the Brutalist moat house is good.
Yeah, yeah, it's perfect. I mean, it really kind of is like a... like, I don't know. It just makes me think of like if you gave somebody in poverty a bunch of money and they're just like, I don't know what to do. I guess I'd get this. Like, a lot of it is kind of that, but I suppose that is kind of the yeah.
Well, keep that in mind as we go to your luxury item.
Yeah.
So luxury now.
Can I have a servant?
Oh my God.
Like,
people have gone really weird this season. Everyone wants another person. Everyone wants to have a person. That's the economy, I guess. That's what it is. Tell us more.
I guess...
you're only allowed a servant if it's robotic.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I was thinking that.
Like, I think we should put that rule in now, yeah. Going forward, Will.
Yeah.
No more people.
No exploitation of humans.
I also think, though, like, am I allowed to do other things? Like, am I allowed... Do I have a kitchen? In this place?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah, then that's fine. Yeah, then I don't want to worry about that stuff. I was going to say, like, if I only have the studio and, like, I just have, like, a food pill that comes out of the wall once a day or something, some sort of thing like that, where I don't really have anything to clean up, and cleaning would probably be my only escape from, like, the hellish task of making music 24 hours a day, then I don't want a servant. But other than maybe to keep me company, then I would say, like, an electron microscope or something would probably be cool.
Okay. Why an electron microscope?
I've always wanted one. I've talked to... There's companies that are making smaller ones now, and I've, like, been like, hey, I have a really popular science YouTube channel. You could send me one of those electron microscopes. I got a garage. I never get a response.
Weird.
But I just want to give myself a really accurate COVID test. No, I would really... I'm obsessed, a little bit obsessed with particle physics, and I would just like to... play with that or see it in real life and interact with it and stuff like that. I don't know if it would be valuable to anybody other than myself and my own entertainment. I don't know if I would actually...
Could have negated your servant luxury item for some kind of particle collider under the studio.
Yeah.
Under the moat. That would work perfectly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, actually, yeah. That'd be...
Just a Hadron collider under the moat.
Yeah. What could go wrong? whoops, I created false vacuum decay. But yeah, I would really like to look at particles. That would be incredible, because it is kind of crazy that there's this entire separate set of physics under the one that we experience. And
yeah.
And I'm also obsessed with phonons, which is like the, particle of sound, so that's Ooh. Pretty interesting. That actually has sound phonons, or like sound particles, may actually bring us quite a few steps further in quantum computing, because it travels slower than light, obviously, and so it could store memory longer. And so
you're talking about the audio equivalent of a photon, which is, so it's a particle of moving sound, or at least that's a way to model it.
Pressure waves
than
it being,
than pressure waves. Okay.
Yeah, phonons. Yeah.
Huh. Fascinating. So where does your interest in all this come from then, Ben?
Trying to take over the world.
Yeah. Yeah. I think when I was always really into science my entire life. Mm. I was just always very into it. And especially as I became an adult, but I dropped out of high school. I never went to college. I had no education whatsoever. And so I figured, you know, I'm never going to be part of this science thing. I'm never going to be a scientist, because I didn't have... You know, I didn't have the privilege of going to college or anything like that. And so I just kind of tapped out on school and, you know, had this terrible life as a professional musician who got to travel around the world and make music at my leisure. No, I'm very happy with that. But I was always a little bit bummed out. And then randomly, I just kind of started getting more involved with independent research, and then had the YouTube channel on top of that. Then I started getting hired for private research gigs. And then sure enough, I guess technically I'm a scientist now. So that's awesome. And I do work with universities, both on research and consulting and also speaking. And sometimes courses and stuff like that will have me as a speaker, even in business and stuff. And it's kind of funny, because there's this bittersweet, like I applied for a lot of scholarships and stuff when I was younger, and I never got any. And there's this bittersweet thing where it's like, oh, so now you want me, or now I'm allowed in this institution. Yeah. But at the same time, it's like such a huge privilege, because, you know, it's sharing knowledge in any way is such a, I mean, well, you're doing it with this podcast. So there's a reason you're addicted to this podcast. That's probably it. It's probably the sharing knowledge with other people and making the world a smarter, or I guess more objective place. I'm not really sure how to describe it.
Yeah, no, for sure.
But the science I study is not English, but Yeah.
Well, on that note, let's wrap up the podcast by talking a little bit about where people can keep up to date with what's going on with you and what you've got going on right now that people can, you know, get involved with or see you live or, you know, join the community. What's tell us about the Ben Jordan Experience for 2024.
Well, I have a YouTube channel where you could see my dumb face talking about a lot of different things. Just wrapped up a documentary about the hum, the phenomenon of where about 2% of people listen to or hear a nonstop hum sound. Most of them are annoyed or worse with it. Do you hear a hum sound?
Yeah, it's not tinnitus. It's not like a high pitched thing.
Yeah.
It's not a low pitched thing. It's just kind of this, it's like a, almost like an having a shell to your ear, like slightly.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't describe it as a hum, but it's like a constant, like, it's like you can constantly hear the room bigger than the room is.
Yeah. Can I ask you like a series of rapid fire questions?
Yes.
Do you take ibuprofen a lot?
No. Maybe I used to, though.
Did it start after you started taking a lot of ibuprofen?
I can't remember ever not having this.
Okay. Do you mind telling me, like, what city you live in or what area?
I live in Bath in the UK, about same place as Peter Gabriel.
Okay.
Who I don't know if he has it as well.
Yeah. Have you had your ears checked? Like, have you ever gone to, like, an audiologist?
Yes, a long time ago, and they were fine, and it was quite a shock that they were fine because I DJ regularly.
Are you left-handed?
No.
Ambidextrous?
I was very ambidextrous as a kid.
Really?
But it kind of got, ish.
Okay.
Sport.
Yeah.
Cricket or baseball and things. It wouldn't. And tennis. Like, it was fine when I was younger.
One of the big things that we came into, because I've researched this for years, especially, I mean, just came out of this project, which was like traveling around interviewing people, doing field measurements and stuff. Ambidextrous people are extremely overrepresented in the data. Like, it's very odd. That's like the one big mystery where it's just like, is it just that like ambidextrous people, where something's causing their ability to do things a little bit differently as a child that also makes them more aware of sounds, or like what could possibly be the connection there? That's probably the biggest mystery that I ran into. But yeah, anyway.
That is interesting.
Sorry for hijacking your podcast.
No.
So I have a YouTube channel, and I obviously have music as the flashbulb, and I roll the scary music. I run an AI company. Which an AI audio company. Well, I'm a partial runner of it. I own part of an AI company. And it is initially primarily concentrated around AI voice models. But here's the kicker. We've taken equity in the company, and we pay the artists not only in license fees, but in dividends. And so all artists have watermarked paid data sets that they are completely in charge of, and it's all done with their consent, and we're trying to create a new form of intellectual property in AI datasets for this next step forward in music production and even film production and stuff like that. And my intention is to expand that to all different types of artwork. So
excellent.
And the name of the company?
VoiceSwap.
Of course.
Yeah. VoiceSwap.ai. It's co-owned. It was founded and it's co-owned by DJ Fresh. There's a lot of great people. I've just created a model for Imogen Heap.
Oh wow!
Amazing.
Okay. Yeah.
Is that out there and available?
It's not available on the site yet. It will be, but yeah, she was just wanted a model for her own work to use to experiment with, and I was yeah, we'll create one for you. And so kind of got back from like the documentary shoot and immediately started working with Imogen.
Well, pass on our regards. We're huge fans. I'd love to have her on this podcast.
Yeah, she's easily one of the most inspiring people in music. Like if you're probably familiar with Imogen's music, Imogen Heap's music, but like just do a little Googling and see what she's accomplished in the last two decades in this industry. It is phenomenal. She's a rocket ship, just always going up. Like I'm always amazed every time I talk to her. I'm just like, wow. Yeah. But
yeah, mega positive and super exciting to be around, like in her presence.
Brilliant person. Yeah.
All right. Well, all that's left to say, Ben, is thank you so much for all your time and great conversation for the podcast.
Thank you so much, Ben.
Thank you, Ben Jordan.
Oh, thank you. Woo! All right.
There we have it. Thank you again to Ben Jordan. Love the choices and the tangents.
Indeed. And Chris, you've got to check out that video about the hum on his YouTube channel. It is fascinating stuff.
I will.
Anyway, thank you so much for listening, and we will catch you next time for another adventure into Studio Foreverdom. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.